Mic session number 17155, reel 1.
Colonel Jeffs, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in a place called Runcorn in Cheshire.
Which year was this?
That was 1923.
How and when did you come to go to Korea?
Well, I joined the 27th Infantry Brigade when it was in UK in early 1949, when it was the Strategic Reserve. And we were sent out to Hong Kong to defend Hong Kong against Mao Zedong's people who were coming down from the north after he'd bottled up the amethyst on the Yangtze River. We went to Hong Kong, I think it was May 49, and we then had three battalions. Well, in fact, we were an independent brigade group, but they decided to send out the whole of the 40th Infantry Division, so we then became just a brigade within 40 Div in Hong Kong. The following year, the Korean War broke out in, I think it was June 1950, and there was a great deal of uncertainty as to whether British troops would be sent there or not. We had a visit from a chap called Strachey, who was, I think, the Minister of War in August, early August 1950. And the brigadier asked him, are we likely to be sent to Korea? And Strachey said, no, we're forming a brigade in the UK, the 29th Brigade, to go to Korea, and that'll be going there in October. You will remain here in Hong Kong. Now, on Saturdays and Wednesdays, I used to play golf with the brigadier. We were the only two in the brigade, of course, who played golf. And he used to pick me up. He lived in Kowloon with his wife. Picked me up at Brigade Headquarters, which was Far East Farm, out on the New Territories. And this Saturday morning, he didn't arrive, which was the following Saturday, the Monday when Strachey had been with us. So I rang his wife. She said, oh, he's had to go across the land forces. He'd been called over there, but he'll be with you shortly. When he arrived, he said, Reggie, no golf today. We go to Korea next Friday. Whereupon an O group was held immediately. And we were told we were taking two battalions only. Then it was the Royal Leicesters and the Argylls. The Americans were going to provide all transport. We would take only specialist vehicles, like the G-Command vehicle and the odd recovery vehicle, that type of thing. The whole thing was top secret. In the battalions, only the commanding officers and the second-in-command, I think the adjutants, were informed. The reason being that going to be announced in the UK, but as Hong Kong was 12 hours ahead of UK, something like that, we couldn't announce it there. You had to wait till dawn in UK. So I had to go up to the battalion, two battalions concerned, to check equipment, serviceability, transport, anti-tank guns, and small arms, radios, and so on. And I went up to the Royal Leicesters and did them during the Saturday afternoon. There was great consternation as to why the Brigade EME was dealing with transport, etc., on a Saturday afternoon. Everyone was highly excited about this, and no one could tell them why. However, they guessed. Obviously, they said, well, we must be going somewhere. I got back to Brigade Headquarters late that evening to be told the Royal Leicesters were not now going. They had the wrong National Service group, apparently, age groups, and the Middlesex were going instead. So I went up to the Middlesex on the Sunday morning and the Argylls and did their equipment, etc. Again, we had the same problems there. And only later that day could people be told what was happening. Later that week, we were told we were going to sail on the Friday, the Brigade Headquarters and the Middlesex Regiment on the Carrier Unicorn and the Argyll and Southern Highlands on the Cruiser Ceylon. We had an escort of two destroyers. We had handed in all our carriers and three tanners and so on back into ordnance. On, I think it was about the Wednesday, we were told, no, the Americans can't supply anything. You've got to take all your own equipment. So, of course, everyone had to rush back to the ordnance depots and take the stuff out again. We obviously weren't able to take it with us on the Royal Naval ships, and they laid on a cargo ship to bring up all the equipment about 10 days, a fortnight later. We also got, as a result of that, an infantry workshops, 11 infantry workshops, and an ordnance field park to support us. But we weren't taking any supporting arms. We didn't have any tanks or artillery. We sailed on the Friday and arrived in Busan a few days later. So rather than going up, the Navy were at one stage a bit worried about Chinese submarines. So they blacked out and put the bulkheads those bulkhead doors and so on in their ships and evacuation stations type of thing. And we became a task force. The Americans have task forces, I think they're called, and they all have a number. And the captain of Unicorn was junior to the captain of Ceylon, so the captain of Ceylon became task force commander. He signaled Unicorn that you would be 0.95 or something like that, some decimal point. And Captain Unicorn signaled that I will not have my ship referred to as a decimal point or digit. My ship is HMS Unicorn. This type of thing went to and fro. However, we arrived in Busan, and we ran aground. The carrier ran aground in Busan Harbour, just top to bottom. There was a very fussy South Korean tug alongside, a large funnel, an old-fashioned tugboat, with a captain who had more gold braid than an admiral on it. And it had a funny type of bridge, but rather like a greenhouse, with lots of glass and wooden bits and pieces. And the cross trees on his mast got caught up with one of those huge Kali life rafts which they have on the side of carriers. And this thing broke loose and fell onto the bridge and absolutely shattered it. Of course, all the troops were peering over, cheered like anything. There was an enormous loss of face for this poor Korean captain, who promptly took his tugboat away in high dudgeon. However, we got off, and we came alongside. And it was very interesting. Alongside, there was an American Negro band rushing up and down, playing Colonel Bogey, the Korean Girls' Choir, singing God Save the King, or so on. And it was all quite exciting. We got our Beatles off, those we'd taken up on the Unicorn, and one or two went on the Ceylon, but most on the Unicorn. And I took the road convoy up to Taegu. We left, I think, about 3 o'clock in the morning. The troops went up by train, and the Navy sent some decontamination squads, they virtually were, to disinfest these trains, because they were absolutely terrible, and they sprayed them all, so the troops had a more reasonable journey north. We had quite an interesting trip up by road, because the roads had been cut at various places by North Koreans, and then they'd withdrawn and so on. We had an American police escort, and we kept stopping and waiting for the road was clear, then we'd go through with our little convoy. And we arrived in the area of Taegu. Now, the drill then was that we were going to wait until our transport equipment arrived on this cargo ship. But the situation was such, the Americans were under such pressure, that they asked brigade commander, was he prepared to go into the line? And he said, yes, I'll have to. And we took over just two battalions. The battalions were under strength. They only had three rifle companies instead of the normal four. 18,000 yards of front, which is an extremely long frontage. Even brigade headquarters had a small sector of the line to hold, and we stood to in the morning and stood to again at night, brigade headquarters, on this line. It was quite interesting because we had in front of us, across the Naktong River, a North Korean infantry division, and there was a gap of 4,000 yards on our left for the next American troops, and part of a mechanized Korean division came through that North Korean division and got in behind us. And in the morning, you could look at the mountains behind us to our rear, and there were lots of little fires burning where they were brewing up their morning tea or whatever they brewed up in the morning. At the same time, there was a major in the Middlesex Regiment, Rowley Gwynn, who got a lot of South Korean police together and so on, and formed a little army, almost a private army, and went up and engaged these people and held them. It was quite interesting. Now, we held the line there. We came under mortar fire and fire from SP guns and tanks on the other side. They used to, if we sent a jeep down the road, occasionally they'd poop at you as we went along this road, because the road ran along the river. If you went too far, you ran into a North Korean machine gun nest. So people had to be very careful. We lost one or two Beatles there, where they missed the turnings for the Argylls, who were the furthest battalion, and came across this wretched machine gun, which they promptly went in the ditch. Then came the breakout from the Naktong position. It was, I think, the day before MacArthur launched his attack at Incheon, the amphibious attack. We crossed the Naktong, or the battalions did, on a small footbridge. There was an American engineer's ferry there, ferrying heavier stuff across. But the same time as the Middlesex and the Argylls crossed on this footbridge, the North Koreans brought up two SP guns, which were probably a mile and a half away down the river, where they could fire over open sights at this crossing. And we found it extremely dicey. And we had a few casualties there, so we decided we'd stop trying to get stuff across in daylight, and we'd wait until darkness. I was walking back up the banks of this river. The river was fairly low, and it had very wide, sandy banks. And these guns opened up, and I think they chased me, because you could normally hear them fire, and then you dropped, and the shell arrived, and then you got up again, because they went in the sand, and most of the stuff went up in the air. However, on this one occasion, I didn't hear the gun fire. And the next thing was a hell of a cramp right behind me, and I was knocked on my face, and a great burning sensation in the middle of my back. I thought, my God, I'd been hit or something. It was terrible. And I lay there, very quietly, and then the pain went, and I thought, oh, I heard that if you're really seriously hurt, you don't feel any pain. So, oh, it's terrible. However, I then started twitching legs and so on, found I could move everything. And I got up. And what it was, I was wearing jungle green, and a very small piece of this shell, must have been only about an eighth of an inch cubed, had gone into the pleat, the back of my jungle green, and it must have been red hot, and it burnt me. That was the burning sensation I had. However, I got back to brigade headquarters and reported back to the brigade commander on the situation. He said we decided we'd go back under cover of darkness and see what we could do then. However, I then went down to the mess truck for a cup of tea, and while I was there, there was a boom and a crunch, and the SP gun must have spotted the setting sun glinting on one of the windscreens of one of our brigade vehicles, although they were camouflaged. Must have spotted this. So we came under fire. And we all got in little holes, trenches, and we got dug there. And this thing kept firing. One of our signallers, who didn't get down quickly, like me, was caught out in the open. But he was unlucky, and when we peered out of our little holes, we found that a big piece of shrapnel had gone right through his tummy, back, taking all his tummy out, and he was lying there dead. And I was sick, actually, because I suddenly realised that could have been me. He was just unlucky. He got a big piece. I got a very, very small piece. In the meantime, the Americans withdrew our artillery support. We had an American battery in support of the Middlesex and the Argylls, who were over the Nakchong River at that stage. They withdrew that without any reference to the brigade commander or anyone else. The first thing we knew they were going was when the forward observation officers received an order on their radio net to, on the gunner net, to withdraw. And they were apparently being withdrawn to take part in MacArthur's push up in going to support the amphibious landing a little later. The brigade commander was absolutely furious about this. But in the meantime, the North Koreans had formed up on a high ridge of 282 and were preparing to attack. So the only thing to do was call in an airstrike. This was newly called in. Now, the spotter plane, which they used Harvard's spotter planes at that stage, and normally Mustangs to drop napalm and so on. The spotter arrived, and we also had a new air contact team, Chappie. The Americans used to put a fighter pilot, someone like that, on the ground with a radio in a jeep, an operator, and he would sit with brigade or with the battalions and direct airstrikes in on where they wanted them, because he could talk to the pilots. This chap didn't go close to the Argylls. He stopped at a small tributary to the river, and he didn't cross it for some reason. The spotter plane said, look, the North Koreans are on this hill. The Argylls want this hill here, napalming. And the Argylls had put out their panels, identification panels, and the spotter plane said, because the air contact team said, no, it's this reference, the target's on this reference. And there's nothing between the two. And although the spotter plane said, look, they've got panels out, he said, no, North Koreans do that. So he directed the Mustangs in onto the Argylls. And, of course, they were napalmed. And the North Koreans attacked at the same time and forced them off 282. Now, Major Kenny Muir, who was the battalion second in command at the time, he had gone over to help with the supply business. And he was the base of the hill, so he rallied, took command and rallied the Argylls and took them back up the hill and recaptured it. But he was hit by automatic fire, it was short range, and was killed. But he got a posthumous VC. He was the first VC of the Korean War, in fact. Now, the brigadier was absolutely livid about all this, and he went off and found, I think it was the army commander, Walton H. Walker, and complained bitterly to him, and he said, all right, well, I'll ensure you get some form of artillery support. The divisional commander said, no, I can't give him any at all. And in due course, an AK-AK regiment arrived, which is not much use to us in mountainous country, or hilly country. They arrived just as it was going dark, and they moved into the location brigade headquarters had been in when it was shelled, because the brigade headquarters moved very quickly from that location, round a hill and hid behind this hill. And we watched the Americans move into this location, and we were so angry with them, we didn't tell them. And of course they had headlights on and everything else, and in due course these SB guns again pooped at them. So the Americans, of course, disappeared very quickly indeed. They left, I think it was one or two guns on their side where they'd fallen in the paddy ditches and so on in their panic to get out, and off they went. And we never saw them again. They came back the next day to get their guns, but they disappeared. I don't think we ever saw them again. I think it was a day or so later when the air contact team we had went up to the top of this hill to get better communication with aeroplanes. And the guns started firing at this jeep, which they saw on top of the hill. And fortunately, the ACT chappie, he spotted the smoke from the guns and located them and put in a napalm strike on them and took them out. And what, in fact, they were doing was they were in the side of a hill and they dug a little tunnel. Or there was a tunnel there, you know, however, they were hiding in a little tunnel. They used to drive out, fire, and then go back in again, and therefore very difficult to spot. But they did cause a lot of trouble. The action then went on. I think we were going towards Songju, the area, and we, brigade headquarters, were moving down the track, and numbers had been up and down this track in our jeeps beforehand, when all of a sudden the 1500 weight, the defence platoon, went up with an enormous bang on a great anti-tank mine. I think one or two mines went off under it. One chap was killed, but the rest were blown into the air and survived. A pioneer sergeant from one of the battalions came along. He was supposedly an expert on mines and said they lay them in threes or something. So people prodded around and found another mine, and I think that accounted for three mines. So, I mean, all right. On the column went the next vertel. That spot was the G Command vertel of Bedford, on a Bedford QL chassis. And that went up, the front offside wheel disappeared into the air and up on the mine. So then we had to get a scammel recovery vertel to get this lot out and clear it. So I personally prodded with my bayonet in front of the scammel to make sure there were no more mines. I wasn't going to take the word of any more pioneer sergeants or anyone. I'm absolutely certain, because I couldn't afford losing a scammel. However, there weren't any more mines there. And we got the route clear, and the brigade went on and went on to a new location. We had great problems with the roads there. There were no metal roads in Korea at that time. There were one or two. I'm wrong that. I think the road between Seoul and Incheon was metalled. But there was nothing metalled in the south, outside the towns. They were just tracks. And, of course, they broke down very quickly under the heavy vertels, type of like which had never been seen in Korea before, I don't think. We had great problems with our... A lot of the roads were on paddy buns, just raised above the surrounding paddy fields. Now, the American method of repairing these roads was bring a tipper lorry along and drop a lot of stones onto it, ballast and so on, which would gradually bed down and build up in the centre of it. But our vehicles, they were mainly four-wheeled, 4x4 or 4x2, three-tonners. They only had two tyres at the rear, carrying all the load. The American 2.5-tonners, the GMCs, they had eight tyres at the rear, so we had four tyres on each side, carrying the load that one tower was carrying in our case. Of course, if they went close to the edge of these roads, the weight was spread over a much greater area of the road, so the thing held. When our poor old three-tonners went to the edge, the road immediately collapsed under them, and they rolled over, so we had an awful lot of trouble recovering those and trying to stop them from going too close to the edge. But, of course, we've got a tanker coming the other way. The driver's bound to pull over. has happened. So that was a problem. We were joined by the 3rd Royal Australian Regiment about this time. They'd come up from Australia. So that then gave us 3 battalions, which, of course, was a much better formation as far as the brigade commander was concerned. He could have 2 forward and 1 in reserve, and so on. I was on the rear link. I used to take my turn on the communications at brigade headquarters, and I was manning the rear link, I think, which was an American-operated thing back to division. When a message came through telling us to report to an airfield for an airlift to Seoul, brigade to Seoul. The vehicle was obviously going up by road. But no paperwork was. No one signed any forms or anything. The whole brigade just reported, as instructed, to this airfield, and they were loaded onto aeroplanes and off they went. The rest of us went up by road through Suwon and up to Seoul and north of Seoul. And then we got involved. I think we were then part of 1st Cavalry Division, commanded by General Hobart Gay, because we served on the American Division all the time, as a brigade within their division. But unfortunately, I say, we had no supporting arms of our own. We got involved in some mixed fighting just over the 38th parallel in the area of Khe Sanh. And we were sent up various tracks and things and didn't make very much progress. For a few days, in fact. Hubert Gay, the commander of 1st Cavalry, told one of our liaison officers, I think it was Ritchie Peters, I'm not sure, who went down to the division headquarters from time to time, to tell that brigadier of yours to get off his arse, was that effect, which was politely put to the brigadier, who was, again, not very pleased, because he hadn't been given any real support, and the tracks we were sent up, they virtually led to nowhere. However, ultimately, we got on our way, and we then led the advance north. And we went through Sariwon, which was the Aldershot of North Korea. Much to the surprise of North Koreans, because the Argylls got into Sariwon first, and there was a junction with the road we were on, and the road came up from the southwest, and the road went on north towards Pyongyang. And North Koreans didn't know we were in Sariwon. Leslie Nielsen, who was commanding the Argylls, went off in his jeep down this road that came from the southwest, and to his horror, came across a long column of North Koreans. It was too late to do anything, so he drove on past them, and I think they shouted Ruski or something. But after a while, the North Koreans twigged what was happening and opened fire, but his driver put his foot down, and they went down this column, got past it, and then hid in a ditch for the night. He spent a very uncomfortable night in the ditch. In the meantime, these people came up to Sariwon and got mixed up with the Argylls in Sariwon. There was quite a bit of fighting went on there. And the Australians, too, were involved in that. We then headed for Pyongyang, and we would have been the first troops into Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, but it was decided politically that was not on, and so we were bypassed down a side road, put down a side road, and a South Korean division went into Pyongyang, and we then followed them in. I do remember how terribly cruel the South Koreans were to the citizens of Pyongyang. I think they'd broken into some liquor stores, because a lot of them were drunk. And they were shooting people in the streets and marching them off, and it really was an awful business. But there was nothing we could do, because we were then ordered to go through Pyongyang to the north of it and hold there. But MacArthur, in the meantime, decided that we were going to go north of Chonchon River and up towards the Yalu River. So we were then ordered north, and we went up towards, I think it was Sinanju and Anju in that area. And we had an interesting little crossing of a river to make there, and there were some assault boats and local boats and so on. The Middlesex went across in those, and fortunately, on the far bank, they were helped ashore by the local Korean civilians. Fortunately, the North Korean army had withdrawn and didn't oppose this landing, otherwise it could have been rather nasty. We then went as far as the small town of village of Pakchon, and then turned left to Fort Chongju, heading west. It was in northwest direction. And we were then about 30-odd miles from the Yalu River when we got to Chongju, but we'd been in the line in action continuously for 30-odd days. Everyone was very tired, so the brigadier asked to be relieved and for an American RCT to be passed through us. And it went through us that evening. Now, in the meantime, there was a lot of worry because there were reports coming in that the Chinamen about. Well, these were denied by MacArthur's headquarters, apparently. But the little gossip in Korea was there were Chinese around. We went into reserve, Jeonju, and then suddenly there were a number of North Korean T-34 tanks around there, and the Australians knocked, I think, four or five of them. And I think the brigade killed about 500 North Koreans in the area of Jeonju before the Americans passed through us. We were in reserve for a short period, and then we were ordered to a place called Taechom, which was more towards Central Korea, a northeasterly direction. It, again, was about 34 miles south of the Yalu River, I think. And we went up to this place, and it was in a valley, very ominous hills all around us. And the brigadier insisted that an American RCT be put in behind us, which it was. One came in behind us because there was nothing between us and the other UN forces. It was about 24 miles to the south of us. This RCT stayed about a few hours and then went. So we were then on our own there. I think we had a troop or squadron of Sherman tanks with us, American, and a battery of their 105 howitzers in support. The patrols went out and came back with two Chinamen. And they indicated there were quite a lot of Chinamen about 2 miles up the valley from us. The air went up and had a look, and they reported about 12,000, they thought, up there. So it was decided we would have to withdraw from there. Now, we could either go straight back to Pakchon, cross country, or we could withdraw via Masan, where the Australians were holding, which meant going down two legs of a triangle, down one edge of the triangle and then along the base. The brigadier asked me to go off at dawn to see if we could get the brigade vertals on this shortcut to Pakchon. I went down in my jeep and decided it was quite impossible. We had lots of 4x2s and so on, and we would not have made it. So I got back to brigade, so we went back via Masan. The Americans were going to provide transport for the infantry. But that didn't arrive, so the infantry marched out, and then transport picked them up in due course. And we got back to the place called Pakchon, ultimately. And we were told to stay there and act as rear guard with the 19th Regimental Combat Team, which was commanded by a Brigadier General, I think it was Davidson, who I think was the Deputy Commander of the 24th Infantry Division. And he acts as task force commander. The Americans have this funny thing. They put in charge of an RCT a task force commander. They have one or more RCTs. And he commanded 19th RCT and ourselves, 19th RCT being about five miles east of us from Pakchon. Well, that was about the 4th of November. And that night, we saw a lot of fireworks in that direction. And they were obviously being very heavily attacked. I suppose about midnight, or 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, when Davidson came up on the air to the brigadier and said, pull out code, we're going, two of our battalions have lost their transport, we are going. Well, Obrico said, no, I'm not moving till daylight. Now, by daylight, the Chinese got in behind us. There was a road that led down to Sinanju and Anju in that area. And he'd put a company of Argyles, fortunately, down this road. And also down the road were the American battery of 105 supporting us. And that morning, they reported they were under heavy fire from the Chinese. And in fact, I've got a photograph somewhere of white phosphorus shells landing on their position. I think it was something the Chinese had captured, landing on this gun battery position. And finally, the guns were firing over open sights. The Argyles came up from the south, the company, and then assisted the gunners in repulsing this attack. And the Chinese then withdrew to the hills, which ran parallel to the road. And the brigade then moved out down that road, in due course. And I remember when I came out with the rear guard, because normally I had trouble with the rear guard, because my job was to destroy any equipment, guns, vehicle, or anything, which were left behind. And I watched at one stage the Argyles attacking across the paddy fields to the hills where the Chinese were. And it was quite interesting watching an infantry attack going in. That night, we established a bridgehead near Anju.